I find this a terribly moving letter. I think Wittgenstein himself, on this particular point, didn't practice what he preached. I think Nietzsche did practice what Wittgenstein here preached. He was nasty enough, I think, to suit any of you. But nasty not just for the sake of being nasty, but nasty because he tried to think really honestly about his own life and other people's lives. Nietzsche himself put the same point a number of times. One of his briefest formulations is that he said that it was a very trite idea to have the courage of one's convictions. What really mattered was to have the courage for an attack on one's convictions, which is another way of saying, in his somewhat more aggressive manner, the courage to examine one's convictions, the courage to re-examine one's convictions, the courage to ask whether there isn't something wrong with them. You find the same thing beautifully expressed in a letter to a sister right at the beginning of the Portable Nietzsche, where he says, "Here the ways of men part. If you want peace of mind, then believe, and if you want to have the truth, then inquire," and where he pictures how difficult a way of life it may be if you inquire, how often you're bound to be unsure, how often your conscience is apt to bother you, how often you may live in what Kierkegaard might have called fear and trembling. I think what makes Nietzsche particularly remarkable is that he is a rare embodiment of what I consider the philosophic, the Socratic philosophic spirit. There may be some things about his personality that are not so attractive. In this respect, I think he is thoroughly admirable. In his uninhibited passion for truth and in his rarely equaled craving for intellectual integrity. These are rare qualities. They are not often encountered. I'll be terribly brief about his life and about his personality. Some of the major points may be very well known to most of you, and so there's no need to dwell on them. One thing that's mildly interesting is that Nietzsche's father was born the same year as Kierkegaard in 1813. I just mention it because it indicates that Nietzsche is really one generation later. He didn't read Kierkegaard. Georg Brandes, who was the first to discover Nietzsche and one of the first to discover Kierkegaard and also helped to discover such people as Ibsen and as Strindberg, called Nietzsche's attention to Kierkegaard in a letter just toward the end of Nietzsche's life, and Nietzsche didn't get around anymore to procuring any of Kierkegaard's works. Nietzsche himself was born in 1844. And died in 1900. His father died when he was a little boy. He was brought up by his mother together with his sister and also with the benefit of a grandmother and two maiden aunts. Eventually escaped to the university where he studied classical philology, and at the very young age of not yet 25, became a professor of classical philology at the University of Basel, Switzerland. The greatest experience of his Basel period, of his period as a professor, was his temporary friendship with Richard Wagner. Also, if I remember right, born in 1813, also of the generation of Nietzsche's father, a very asymmetrical friendship in which Wagner appreciated the young intellectual who was his errand boy, bought Christmas presents for the family, could be persuaded to append to his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, a long, very purple prosy eulogy of Richard Wagner. And that was appreciated by Wagner at a time when Wagner was not much appreciated. But sooner or later, this relationship had to come to an end, even if the particular things that did happen hadn't happened, because Wagner had no interest in Nietzsche striving for intellectual independence, had no sympathy at all for Nietzsche's particularly personal aspirations, so that Nietzsche could either give those up permanently and just become a publicity man for Wagner, or had to break with Wagner. He did the latter. It happened after Wagner went to Bayreuth and established there a great center of Wagnerism, also of anti-Semitism and Francophobia and all sorts of political ideas that Nietzsche didn't like. The capstone, as many of you know, was when Wagner wrote Parsifal, which Nietzsche thought was a very unpleasant affair, because he did not for a moment think that Wagner really now had faith, but felt that the old atheist who had prided himself on his atheism and called himself Schopenhauer's first disciple, and also a modern Aeschylus, that this man now was using Christianity and the idea of the pure fool, a very un-Greek idea, for theatrical effect. So they broke. Nietzsche, shortly after, also resigned from the university and then lived for another 10 years in relative poverty in Switzerland and Italy most of the time, Switzerland in the summers, Italy in the winters, and his heroism, which I think was very real, was very different from those immediately, from those terribly theatrical busts and drawings that you have seen with the huge moustaches that were commissioned by the sister after he had become insane and was an imbecile and could not protest. His heroism consisted in the fact that his health was terrible, that the doctors kept advising him to take it easy, to take care of his eyes, not to read so much, not to write so much, and that he burnt himself out publishing, not like Kierkegaard, so many books a year, but quite steadily one book a year, and put everything into that until there was nothing left of him anymore, and he became insane. The insanity, according to most of the people who have studied it posthumously, was probably a general paralysis, in which case there must presumably have been a syphilitic infection. Those who have studied the matter dispassionately have charged that Nietzsche may, as a student, once or twice have visited a brothel. This is not well attested, but it certainly is very possible. It's also possible, not that it greatly matters to me, I don't see why it should matter to you, that when he was a medical orderly during the Franco-Prussian War, he might have become infected as he was taking care of sick soldiers. What does matter, what is relevant, is whether Nietzsche's works can be shrugged off as the writings of a madman. And this is a popular idea with people who don't know much psychology, with amateur psychologists, but perhaps it's interesting to hear what Freud thought of Nietzsche. Freud said of Nietzsche that he had, and I quote, a more penetrating knowledge of himself than any other man who ever lived or was ever likely to live. Rather a handsome compliment, I think. I'm not at all sure that it's true, but I find it quite stunning anyway, that he had a more penetrating knowledge of himself than any other man who ever lived or was ever likely to live. That presumably includes Sigmund Freud himself. He also said of Nietzsche that his insights often agree in the most amazing manner with the laborious results of psychoanalysis. And that, although in his later years, Freud didn't have any particular enthusiasm for Nietzsche, whose whole temperament was very different from his own in many respects. There's no need, I think, to go over a list here of Nietzsche's books. They're usually divided into three periods. First, things like The Birth of Tragedy and The Untimely Meditations, essays, then as aphoristic works, the ones that really are aphoristic, that consist of lots of short sections strung together, and then in his final period, first Das Buch Zarathustra, then Beyond Good and Evil, Genealogy of Morals, And then finally, in his last year, last conscious year, 1888, he equaled Kierkegaard by writing in 1 year The Case of Wagner, The Twilight of the Idols, The Antichrist, Ecce Homo, and composing out of things written earlier, Nietzsche contra Wagner. Now, there is an enormous amount to be said about Nietzsche's philosophy, which I shall not say tonight, and perhaps this is a good moment to give you briefly some bibliographical suggestions for Nietzsche and for this whole series of three lectures. If you are willing to look at two books, assuming that you haven't already read one or both, the two that I would advise, both in connection with Nietzsche and with this whole section of three, and in terms of which I think you would get much more out of the whole series than if you just listened to the lectures, are Existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre, mainly for texts by the men themselves, and My From Shakespeare to Existentialism for interpretations of the men, including Nietzsche. For Kierkegaard, if you want to do some additional reading, I would say the work of his to read is Fear and Trembling, the work about him to read, which also is available, like everything I am mentioning in paperback, Walter Lowry's Short Life of Kierkegaard, which is enormously sympathetic and I think illuminating. That's a paperback by the Princeton University Press. The others are respectively Anchor and Meridian. For Nietzsche, for the texts, the portable Nietzsche, there are some important works that are in the modern library, Giant Nietzsche, and not in the portable, and vice versa for that matter. I do think that some of the translations in the modern library, Giant, are travesties. For an interpretation of Nietzsche that covers points that I shall not bring up tonight, there's my own little Meridian book on Nietzsche. And for Sartre, whom I want to discuss next week, if you want to read one thing by him in addition to the things in Existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre, I'd suggest No Exit and three other plays, and preferably of those, No Exit and The Flies. And if you're willing to tackle a big university press book, that is a very good secondary text on French existentialism, Hazel Barnes, The Literature of Possibility. Now, to speak briefly about Nietzsche's philosophy, I will first mention two major misconceptions of Nietzsche. One of them, Nietzsche as a Nazi, a view that used to be popular in this country during World War II, but also was popular in Germany just preceding World War II, although I think not quite as popular really in Germany as here, because more people in Germany knew their Nietzsche, had read them, and knew how many things there were in Nietzsche that didn't square with Nazism. And I dare say that this view is quite universally abandoned by Nietzsche scholars. I don't think that on this, I wouldn't be afraid to say so if I stood alone on this and if I thought I was right against the world, but that is not the situation. In fact, I think that Nietzsche scholars are pretty well agreed that this is a very serious misreading of Nietzsche, that Nietzsche, to give a couple of examples, did not say, my ideal is Cesare Borgia, but he said that he liked even Cesare Borgia better than Parsifal, and that wasn't saying very much coming from Nietzsche. Or when he spoke of the blonde beast, which he did, I think, all of three times, he had in mind by the blonde beast a lion, and was referring to the brute health and strength of the Teutonic races before they became Christianized. He did think there was something nice about a lion, but if you want to know what he really, seriously, as a philosopher, thought of the blonde beast and of the lion, you need read no further than the first chapter, I mean the first chapter now and not the prologue, of Zarathustra, where you get the image of the lion as not the highest thing. There are three transformations or metamorphoses And the first one is the camel, the beast of burden that humbly accepts tradition. Then the lion, the beast, the revolutionary that throws it off. And finally, the creative child. And so for Nietzsche, quite generally, there's not high-handed exegesis, but quite generally, the blonde beast was very far from being his ideal. And so one could run through various other slogans that have been misinterpreted. I won't do it now. In the chapter on how Nietzsche revolutionized morals in From Shakespeare to Existentialism, you will find a very brief treatment, one after the other, of these major misconceptions. The only other one that I do want to mention is that among those who have given up any notion that Nietzsche was a Nazi are those who have developed about him what you might call the incoherence theory, namely that he was completely incoherent and that he said absolutely anything on any subject that just happened to come to his mind. In a kind of rarefied or sublimated way, this theory is championed by Karl Jaspers, who sees Nietzsche in some such way and sees great glory in this. He thinks this is a wonderful thing because whatever position you may adopt, Nietzsche sort of shocks you out of it by saying something else, and so you are, in Jaspers' words, set whirling. Now, if one reads Nietzsche the way Karl Jaspers reads him, which is by way of file cards that you write down juicy quotations, and then you sort of look now at this and now at that, you can be set whirling, that's very true, but you can do something like that, not quite so easily, but quite a number of writers, in fact, with all writers of very great scope, perhaps. Certainly you could do it with Plato, for example. I think that Nietzsche isn't as incoherent as all that, that there is in Nietzsche a coherent doctrine. The other existentialists agree on that. Heidegger finds a coherent doctrine in him, albeit one that I don't find in him. Sartre and Camus, I think, find some coherence in him, so do any number of people. Now, I should briefly mention some of these doctrines, at least, and I will dwell relatively longest, I'll be brief on all of these points, on Nietzsche's psychology. This relates him, as most of the things that I am stressing do, even if I don't keep emphasizing it in every sentence, this relates him to existentialism. What the existentialists have in common is their concern with human nature, with human existence. Now, psychology has been a traditional concern of philosophers. Plato was interested in psychology, Aristotle was, Spinoza was in a big way, Hume was, as I mentioned before. But in Nietzsche there are several innovations. The first one is that he quite deliberately puts his conception of man, both of man as he is and of man as he might be, quite emphatically in the center of his thought, and coins a word for his idea of man as he might be. The word in German is Übermensch. In English, this has sometimes been translated in a word that has become debased currency, Superman. It's better, I think, for a variety of reasons to use the word overman for it. Moreover, still much more interesting, Nietzsche, in considering the views of others, in his literary criticism, in his criticism of religion, and in his criticism of philosophers, looks for their visions of man, looks for the visions of man that they presuppose, perhaps unconsciously, explicates these hidden visions of man in other people's philosophies, and then criticizes them. And he bases his psychology on a much broader empirical fundament than I think any philosopher before him, which is what earned him Freud's compliments. His own major psychological concepts have been, I think, insufficiently studied and contrasted with those of Freud and Freud's successors. The chief ones are, first of all, the conception of the will to power. The will to power, as understood by Nietzsche, is by no means just the vulgar sort of striving for power, which finds expression in militarism and imperialism. Nietzsche was as sharp a critic of the Bismarck Empire as that empire produced. He had no admiration for that sort of thing at all, but descriptively found in that too, of course, an expression of a will to power, but he also found the will to power everywhere else. He found it in Christianity in a peculiar form, he thought, and he could quote St. Thomas Aquinas and any number of other great saints along these lines, that the Christian, having despaired of this world, hopes to go to heaven, and then from heaven behold the torments of his masters, of his enemies in hell. He too wants power, but having despaired of power in this world, seeks power in another world. The artist too seeks power, the philosopher too seeks power. We have here as comprehensive a monistic theory as we find in the early Freud, and a theory that might well be weighed in the balance against the dualism of the older Freud. Just as when Freud tried to supposedly explain everything in terms of sex, this meant that in fact he reinterpreted the traditional idea of sex, that what he finally meant by the sex impulse was something much less crude than what some other people had meant. So what Nietzsche means when he speaks of the will to power is also something just a little more subtle, something a little more polymorphic, something a little more protean. And just as Freud could hardly be said by an intelligent person to have endorsed or celebrated the sex impulse, so it is stupid, I think, to say of Nietzsche that he endorsed or celebrated the will to power. Another conception, psychological conception of Nietzsche's, which bears out what I've just said about the will to power, is the conception of sublimation. It was Nietzsche who first used that word sublimation in its contemporary sense, and his whole conception of the will to power, his whole psychology of the will to power, depends on this idea of substitutions, that people again and again settle for what is second best, that when they can't get what they most want, then they will settle for brute power, for physical power, for cruelty, which isn't what they really want, but what is, in modern terminology, to be explained in terms of frustration. Nietzsche's key word here is the word resentment, and he finds resentment central in Christianity, and finds resentment central in a great deal of traditional morality. And he initiates something for which Karl Jaspers coined a nice title in one of his early books, namely Psychology of Weltanschauungen, to look at Weltanschauungen and understand the psychological basis of them. Now what I might do, but definitely shall not do, at least in the lecture part, if you want to bring it out in discussion, all right, is deal specifically with Nietzsche on religion, to tie it up with last week's lecture, and with Nietzsche on morality, to tie it up with next week's lecture. The reason I will not do this is because I see no point in repeating in a lecture what I have written and published. So for those particularly interested in Nietzsche on religion, I may mention the chapter on Nietzsche's repudiation of Christ in my little book on Nietzsche. For those interested in Nietzsche and morality, the chapter already mentioned on how Nietzsche revolutionized morals in From Shakespeare to Existentialism. What I still want to say about Nietzsche's philosophy is that perhaps one can illuminate it by suggesting that there are three different types of philosophy encountered in Nietzsche. First of all, the traditional kind of philosophy, which I think in understanding Nietzsche is least important, though Heidegger, very perversely to my mind, stresses this and only this in his essay on Nietzsche, in his essay, not translated into English, on Nietzsche's word, God is dead. And this is the metaphysician in Nietzsche. He thinks that Heidegger thinks that Nietzsche was the last great metaphysician of the West. Plato, perhaps the first, and Nietzsche the last. Well, there is some metaphysics in Nietzsche. The will to power does become, in the late Nietzsche, also, among other things, on top of everything else, a metaphysical hypothesis. He has to out Schopenhauer and say, Schopenhauer thought the ultimate reality was the will to live. No, it isn't that, it is the will to power. but I think this is a wholly marginal part of Nietzsche's philosophy. The two parts of Nietzsche's philosophy that are strong are one, the analytic, and two, the existential. And this is what I have in mind when I think of Nietzsche as not himself a clear-cut existentialist, but as sort of the waterfed, the last great world historical philosopher in whom these two timeless tendencies are still very well fused. Well, in our time, there has been a dissociation of sensibility, and we have the analyst speaking English and the existentialist speaking German and French. Let me illustrate the analytic element in Nietzsche very briefly, and I will stress here particularly things that have to do with emphasis on language and grammar to link him with what's going on in analytic philosophy today. You find, for example, as analytic philosophy, his analyses of God, of the true world, of morality, of the good, of the four great errors, all in the twilight of the idols contained in the portable Nietzsche. You find him saying such things as, language talks of opposites, but there are only degrees and many refinements of gradation. He speaks of the misleading errors of language and the fundamental fallacies of reason which have become petrified in language, which understands and misunderstands all activity as due to an agent, a subject. Again, he says that when there is thinking something, something must exist that does think is simply a formulation of our grammatical habits which couple all doing with a doer. There's plenty of this sort of thing in Nietzsche, which you might call anti-metaphysical and positivistic. But there is, of course, in Nietzsche also a great deal that links him with existentialism, and I'll just enumerate his literary criticism, something in which Heidegger, Sartre, and Camus have also engaged in a big way, his psychological interests, his critique of Christianity and of Weltanschauungen generally, his analysis of nihilism and of different possible attitudes toward an absurd world, particularly relevant to the sort of thing that Sartre and Camus have done, his celebration that I've read to you of a new greatness of man, and his attempt to cross over from philosophy into literary attempts. It is therefore not surprising that Karl Jaspers should have written two books about Nietzsche, that Heidegger should have written an important essay about him, that Nietzsche's name should be the first name mentioned in Sartre's Being and Nothingness, and that Camus has written at length about him too. They are interested in him, they realize that in some sense he is one of theirs. It's high time for a conclusion, so that there will be time for some discussion. I've said that a philosopher probably should stand somewhere between literature, poetry on the one hand, and science on the other. And I think if one wants to criticize Nietzsche, one may well say that although this makes him readable and appealing and interesting, he stands a little too far in the direction of out-and-out literature, that there is too little in him of careful summing up, of taking together the different things he has said and himself comparing them instead of just leaving it to somebody else to do this and seeing what stands up, what doesn't stand up, what has to be qualified. There is too little of that. There are many other criticisms that one can make of Nietzsche, just as in the case of Kierkegaard and of Sartre next week. I don't want to press all of these. One might just pick out one so that you see in what direction I might proceed. I think that occasionally he makes much too sharp a dichotomy between the higher man, the superior person, and the rest of mankind. But one would also have to say that if you read him thoroughly, you find him in other places trying to balance this. The whole fourth part of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, for instance, makes fun of the higher man and makes the point, quite literally, that the higher men stink. I want to end on a positive note, and I will say in conclusion that for all his faults, I think there are exceedingly few philosophers or writers to equal Nietzsche in a fusion of three things, of scope, of which he has far more than almost any other philosopher. There's scarcely anything that might interest you intensely that he doesn't deal with. This in itself is no accomplishment. It might all be superficial for all that. So we have to take with this the second point he fuses with it, depth. Whatever he deals with, I think, he goes, if not to the bottom of it, he goes very deep. He is very profound. He makes us see things we didn't see before. And then together with the scope and depth, which for all that might be tedious, might be a bore, except for people with a very strong intellectual stomach, he has also a great deal of passion, which makes him contagious, which is a good thing, which makes him inspire other people to be interested and to care strongly. And if you take him all in all, I do think, on reflection, the more I think about him, that he was one of the greatest philosophers and writers of all time. There are very few other philosophers that one can come back to again and again and read for pleasure.